Welcome to The Real Deal in Sports, a show about the cultural, social, political, spiritual, and economic impact of sports on the world at large. I'm Josh Chetwin, and thanks for listening in. We also hope you'll contribute with questions and comments as our phone lines are open. You can reach us at 303-442-4242. As we wade through all the postmortems of last week's elections, it's worth noting that in ways both obvious and subtle, sports impacted the dialogue of this election season. When President-elect Donald Trump used big league or described himself as a counterpuncher, he was invoking the language of the games we play. While it should go without saying Trump is certainly a unique political figure, he is not alone in using sports as a linguistic crutch. His opponent, Hillary Clinton, had a long history of relying on sports idioms in public discourse. In 2006, while a senator, she said to the New York Daily News when asked about how the Bush administration was going to handle internal discord in Iraq, quote, "The last thing I heard is they're going to punt it for another 18 months," end quote. In 2010, as Secretary of State, she commented when talking about rebuilding efforts in Haiti that, quote, "We have a full court press going on here," end quote. This reliance on sports language is not a new thing. Teddy Roosevelt famously invoked boxing when he indicated in 1912 he'd run for president with the phrase, quote, "My hat is in the ring," end quote. And Richard Nixon was a huge fan of this language when he constantly referenced game plan, a football term, during his presidency, which was something we learned about in the Watergate tapes. This language is so ingrained in our political thinking that we don't pause when we hear soccer moms or NASCAR dads, or the litany of horse racing terms that frame election seasons, including, but not limited to, inside track, runoff, running mate, too close to call, or having a horse in the race. Other politically popular sports terms include unforced error from tennis and the more generic game changer, which have both become catnip for the pundit class in the 21st century. No doubt, the use of this language emphasizes the reductive up-and-down nature of these contests rather than the policy issues. Analysts across radio, television, and print never seem to stray too far from the horse racing analogies. The question, is this a problem? And would excising some of this language from political conversation help us refocus on more meaningful topics? And how much of a role did sports language play in our most recent election? I have two distinguished guests today to discuss. Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal and former columnist for The Boston Globe and The New York Times Magazine. He was also the first ever recipient of the Linguistic Journalism Award and has worked as the executive editor of Vocabulary.com and the Visual Thesaurus. He was also editor of American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press and as a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary. And my second guest is Barbara Partee, and she is a distinguished university professor emerita of linguistics and philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is one of the founders of contemporary formal semantics in the United States and is the former president of the Linguistics Society of America. As is always the case, we'd like to hear your thoughts and opinions on this subject, so please call in at 303-442-4242. But before we go to the phone lines, I'd like to get to our guests. Ben, Barbara, thank you both so much for coming on The Real Deal in Sports.
Thank you for having us.
Wonderful. Ben, I'd like to start with you. I know you're such a keen observer of how language shapes the popular culture. How much was sports a part of the language we heard during our contentious presidential election?
Well, it always seems to be, and as you pointed out, very often the metaphors that are most prominent are the horse racing metaphors. You named several. You know, the whole idea of having a front runner or someone being a long shot or a dark horse, all of those that come out of horse racing have been with us for a while, have been transferred to politics for quite a while. But certainly this last time it was as prominent as ever, and we heard plenty of complaints about how commentators were focusing too much on the horse race, getting kind of swept away with the horse racing metaphor, who's in front, who's the front runner, and that sort of thing, at the expense of talking about actual policy initiatives and the positions of the candidates. And so I think that the fact that we have commentators who are always looking at the polls and are looking for kind of a metaphorical basis to express this and draw on horse racing as well as other sports means that that kind of metaphorical grounding in sports talk has been as prominent as it ever has been.
Barbara, does the choice to use sports language say something about candidates who choose to use it? And we'll definitely talk about the pundit class and their usage, but the candidates themselves, such as Donald Trump calling himself a counterpuncher, are those choices, are they done without forethought? Is it just something that's reflexive? Or are they actually making a choice when they use those phraseologies?
Well, I can't see inside their heads, but I would imagine that it's likely such an ingrained kind of thing for all of us. I don't myself notice when I use sports metaphors, and I'm sure I do too. So I would expect it has really just become deeply part of the way we talk about any competitive situation.
Ben, I want to drill down on the use of horse racing metaphors in particular, because I mentioned a few other ones, and I know you've written on Unforced Error as one that's become popular, or Game Changer, which just seems so ubiquitous when talking about politics. But horse racing metaphors are really at the center of this issue, and the issue of making it very reductive in terms of how we look at politics. Does that say something specific about American culture that we use those particular metaphors?
I don't know if it's specific to American culture, but it certainly has taken off in a serious way. You know, I think a lot of this just goes to the fact that much of our most sort of colorful writing and inventive styles of journalism come out of sports journalism. So going back to the 19th century, if you had sports writers talking about a horse race, talking about, you know, baseball game, later other types of sports like football and basketball, that's where a lot of the action was linguistically. So it's not completely surprising that this sort of colorful language ends up getting transferred metaphorically. When it comes to the horse race of a political campaign, though, I think again, it has a lot to do with just the way that we reduce all of this to polling, who's ahead in the polls, and it's very easy to make that leap into just sort of envisioning the whole thing as a horse race. And in fact, some websites, including Huffington Post and Slate, this political season, actually created graphic visualizations showing the poll numbers as if the candidates were jockeys on horses in a race. So really making that metaphor explicit. So it's compelling. It's an easy story to tell, and it avoids a lot of the complexities of political discussion that we would otherwise be talking about.
It's interesting, though, that the choice is horse racing. You make the very fine point that at the end of the 19th century and into the start of the 20th century, sports was a haven for great writing, whether it was Ernest Hemingway, Ring Lardner, Damon Runyon, all these great writers who chose to use sports. But equally as popular during that period were boxing, were baseball. But horse racing seems to be more sort of basic. You know, you're hopping on the horse and there's not a lot of confusion or rules to the process. It's just go at it as fast as you can. Does that make it the most apt metaphor for what we do in politics?
I think so, yeah. I would say so, yeah. I don't know if Barbara agrees, but it does seem that way. I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree with you. I think so. I mean, in horse racing, you have this very clear sense of who is ahead and who is behind during the course of the competition. And that just makes it a very natural metaphor.
I was particularly fascinated in doing research on this that this is not something new. You know, you can go back to the 1850s and find in American newspapers the use of inside track with a clear reference to the horse racing meaning for that, but talking about it in a political context, and then go to England and find dark horse being referenced in relation to the British Parliament in the 1840s. Barbara, to what extent could this be actually sort of a carryover from Britain? Because clearly horse racing was a huge sport in England, predating even the 19th century. Do we find that a lot of our language choices come from that version of English, or is this something that may be sort of uniquely American?
Well, I'm really not expert on that question. I mean, in general, once we formed our own country, we started diverging in many, you know, local kinds of things we would talk about and how we would talk about them. But it's It's certainly possible. I wanted to mention that even some of these sports metaphors themselves, I think some of them come from war and battles and the general idea of fighting, all the stuff about winning and losing, and beating your opponent and killing. I guess killing is also a volleyball term, but you know it's used in general for a big victory over someone. It comes from wars, battles, fights, and some of that may well have come into sports language from war language, and even the notion of campaign. We talk about the election campaign. Campaign is a war metaphor. So it may be hard sometimes to separate the sports language from the war and battle language.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, we think of the war room as a popular phrase in politics. Mm-hmm. In a way, is it euphemistic then to go with sports language, sort of a euphemism / metaphor, in that maybe the general public may be a little turned off if we were to get more heavily into war and military language when talking about elections, and this sort of softens it one level?
Yeah, I mean, like, weren't the Olympics supposed to be a substitute for just going to war with each other?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU Radio in Denver and Boulder. Our topic today is sports language and its impact on politics. The most recent elections saw its normal litany of horse race analogies, and the candidates certainly use sports language. Does this emphasis on competitive speech have an impact on how we look at politics, policy, and elections? What does the choice say about America and Americans? We'd love to have your thoughts and contributions to the discussion. As always, you can call us at 303-442-4242. My guests are Ben Zimmer, who writes the Word on the Street language column for the Wall Street Journal, and Barbara Partee, who is a distinguished university professor emerita of linguistics and philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Ben, we talked quite a bit about the sports language in the context of elections. It's just interesting to think about how much presidents have an affinity to sports language. I mentioned Richard Nixon. I mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, the two candidates who were running this time around. Outgoing President Barack Obama was a particularly huge fan. He'd often use sports metaphors. I noticed at the final White House Correspondents' Dinner speech, for example, he made fun of Ted Cruz for calling a basketball hoop a basketball ring. Are sports a sort of lingua franca for politicians? Do they have to know it? And if they do, why is that the case?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. One could argue that perhaps these are rather, you know, macho masculine endeavors. And since men have dominated politics for so long, you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, he's sort of a man's man and that sort of figure of a very pugnacious male politician. Although it should be mentioned that, you know, women in politics use sports metaphors too. A good example was Hillary Clinton's concession speech, where she told her campaign workers, "You left it all on the field, every single one of you." So, you know, that's a metaphor from, you know, football and other sports, this idea that that you leave it all on the field, you give a total effort, nothing is held in reserve for the future contest. And so these things just sort of pervade political talk, and you know, perhaps it has a basis in this idea that of a kind of, again, macho endeavors. But I think that it becomes such a, as you say, a lingua franca for any kind of competitive confrontation that it carries over naturally to politics, whether people come out of some sort of athletic background or not.
Barbara, I want to just drill a little deeper on this idea. I recently had a discussion with an Atlantic reporter on this topic, and both of us came to the conclusion that CEOs rarely use this language. She had done some reporting on this fact. And in fact, in full disclosure, I wrote a book on sports idioms called The Field Guide to Sports Metaphor. And in an early iteration of the book, I was asked to come up with quotes from famous people for each of the 100 or so entries I had in the book. And it was so easy to find examples of politicians using sports metaphors. And also entertainment professionals, but it was a little rarer in business folks. Do you have any thoughts as to why, perhaps, because, you know, business is competitive too, why maybe politicians in particular are drawn to these sort of metaphors? And not to put you on the spot, because I know it's kind of a broad question, the Atlantic Reporter had posited that it's because CEOs are rarely talking to the common people, so they don't need to use the language as much, and you do need to use it more when you're sort of reaching out to the common folk.
That's an interesting question, too, and I hadn't thought about it before. I wonder if it could also be because businesses, when they're talking themselves up, they don't usually talk directly about the opposition. I mean, unless you're in some Mac versus PCs or Coke versus Pepsi specific thing, we should look at their language and see what they do. But mostly you're talking about your own company and all the good things about it, and I don't think we see it so directly as the direct head-to-head competition that we see in politics. Maybe?
Ben, I think that's a very fair point. And Ben, do you think that the more contentious the political election, and we went through probably one of the most contentious political elections in recent memory at the presidential level, do you think that draws in more sports analogies then in those sort of situations because of that idea that the competitive nature is even greater? Or is it just pretty much similar across the board?
It's possible that, you know, the more competitive races would attract more of that kind of language. I mean, again, just like, you know, Hillary Clinton saying, you know, we left it all out on the field. It's almost as if, you know, that concession speech was a locker room, after the game where the coach is, you know, talking to the players. It has that kind of feel. And so if politicians are imagining themselves as coaches or competitors in a particularly heated matchup, then, yeah, we would naturally expect that language to sort of pervade the political discourse even more thoroughly.
We have our first caller, John in Boulder. John, you're on KGNU Radio.
Hi there. I just wanted to contribute a couple. I'm not a tremendous sports fan, but I do think that there is a very clear analogy between having a message for the masses delivered from on high in a language that is understandable and that appeals to a majority of Americans. And curiously, we have the us and them and the winner and the loser and the two-party system that we employ in politics. To the exclusion of much other potential thought. And we have the famous quote by George Tenet, who was the CIA director, giving the president at the time, George W. Bush, confidence that he could take a sample of white powder and give it to Colin Powell at the UN and call it a slam dunk. And that was an appeal to the people to make sure that everybody knew that this potential threat from Iraq was real. And in that language, it appealed to many Americans. It happened to be false. It happened to be part of the weapons of mass distraction campaign. But nevertheless, it was there. We also talk about end games in the military planning, the single integrated operational plan for nuclear attack. The end game scenario was always one that came up, and many others. But I just wanted to contribute those to get you guys to think. Thank you. Bye.
John, are you still there? I just wanted to ask you your opinion. Is there something about sports beyond the competitive nature? Because clearly the competitive nature lends itself very easily. But if sports weren't so popular in the United States, perhaps they wouldn't have traction. Does this speak to the importance of sports as a part of American culture? I know you say you're not a sports fan, but is it?
Well,
how about
just looking at the money? I used to work for somebody that was affiliated with the NFL in a licensing compact, and the amount of money in the organized sports arena, and especially in under what would be considered in other countries, underaged sports competitors, meaning the college level, the amount of pervasive intrusion into college sports with huge rewards that are, you know, potentially dangled in front of these poor scholastic neophytes who are trying to get an education but go in there with the promise of making huge amounts of money in sports again. So sports is an integral part of what I call the American distraction, which is to keep the minds of the people off of the more boring and cogent aspects of running their own country and being, you know, cognizant about their own governments and the way their governments work. And sports happens to be a massive part, the militarization of sports with jets flying over stadiums and marching bands and, you know, always the connection, let alone the terrific story about the two brothers, you know, who gave up their NFL careers to enlist in the U.S. Army Rangers, and the horrible story about the profligate use of propaganda to back the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan with one of those individuals. The family has yet not to, you know, have any sort of solace or consolation from the U.S. government for their loss. So there is this intense weave, I must say, between the sports world and professional sports in the United States especially, but also in Britain, which takes after us and which emulates us in many a way. And, you know, these are both technically large countries that continue their sort of colonial quest in certain areas of the world to ameliorate whatever they see as national interest. And sports certainly comes into that. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you so much for your call, John. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU Radio in Denver and Boulder. Our topic today is sports language and its impact on politics. The most recent election saw the normal litany of horse racing analogies from dark horses to too close to call, and the candidates certainly used sports language is certainly at the top of the two-party system's tickets. Does this emphasize this emphasis on competitive speech have an impact on how we look at politics, policy, and elections? We'd love to hear from you. As always, you can call us at 303-442-4242. Barbara, I want to bring you in on what the caller, John, was talking about, because I think that the implicit suggestion in what he was saying was that we would be better served if we could start excising some of these sports analogies out of our talk when it comes to politics, because it may focus us better on policy. What's your thought about that as someone who understands semantics so well?
Well, I wanted first to add in another aspect of the broader issue that I think John's comments were relating to, and that is the entertainment aspect of sports and how the media too often seem to market political fights as entertainment, like sports. I mean, media is driven by what sells, and entertainment clearly sells. It's part of the same issue of how much money is in all these things. So if politics is marketed as a kind of competitive endeavor which can be seen as entertainment, that makes the sports language eminently natural, also for the reason that Ben mentioned, that so much colorful writing started in sports writing. I noticed in a nice student-run online journal that I hadn't seen before called Lexia at James Madison University. There was an article a couple of years ago by a student named Daniel Vies called The Impact of Sports Metaphors on the Media and Public Sphere. And he talks about the same things we've been talking about, and then he also mentions that not only does the tendency of media to present politics as a game worsen the extreme polarization in Washington, but it also sets up the rest of us as spectators. It frames politics as a spectator sport rather than as something with direct public participation in the town meeting kind of tradition. So participation comes mainly through cheering or heckling, cheering the people we like or heckling or harassing the people we don't like. And that, you know, that could also... Maybe I hope this doesn't get too far off, but that may also relate to what we've been reading lately about how there is all this terrible polarization and negativity at the national level, at the same time that in many, many local elections and local political scenes, things are going in an extremely progressive direction. So where people are really in participatory government, things seem to go pretty well. And it's this national scene that we all look at from such a distance, and we become mere spectators.
Barbara, just out of curiosity on this entertainment piece, what is driving it? Does the language drive this desire for entertainment, or is the language just a means to an end? Is it that the decision is made, we are going to make this more entertaining, we're going to try and make this more of a game, you know, as I said before, be reductive about it, or does the language come, because we're talking about great writers who are looking for metaphors, they're trying to reach out for metaphors, and that was sort of one of the leading factors here. Did they choose the language, and then we jumped on the idea of making an entertainment? Which sort of drove this idea?
Well, as a linguist, I would love to say that language drives everything, but I really doubt it. I really think it's the money. I mean, what drives the media is money, and what's driving these entertainment aspects is money, I think, and the intensity of the competition, I think, drives people to use whatever language they think will be most effective. And the sports metaphors, as we've noted, reach people in a very accessible and colorful language.
We have another caller. It's Jeff in Centennial. Jeff, you're on KGNU Radio.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying your topic so far. I guess my perspective here, too, I'm not sure if there's a way on this, but there's two elements I'd like to bring up, is that sports metaphors, I'd like to think, tap into an emotional feel that your sports team that you root for, you know, you ride the emotional highs and lows, and you can conceive of and accept what the politicians might be speaking to you on, so it communicates to you more on an emotional level rather than on an intellectual level. But the second thing that is, to me, kind of disturbing is that I think sports has pervaded in such a way that their political party, they will adopt as a sports team rather than voting in their interest or perceiving what does this political party stand for, what are the issues they stand for. And regardless of whether they enjoy winning or losing, that they will stay with that political party because that's their sports team, and they might be voting in their own self-interest in that way. So just conceptual thoughts here, and I'd love to hear your opinions from both your guests.
Jeff, I just want to ask you very quickly as a follow-up on that, because I think it's a really insightful opinion that there's the emotional piece. Do you think when the media makes those choices that they have the forethought and they're thinking in those terms, or do you think it just sort of kind of comes with the territory of knowing that you want to get people excited? In other words, is it just they're looking for inherent drama, and so they choose this language? Or do you think they make the connection between the idea of emotionally rooting for a team / emotionally rooting for a politician?
Oh, I would say yes, whether it is a conscious thought or a subconscious thought. I think that both could play in there. I would argue that most of the corporate media, mainstream media, the media in general right now, want you to have an emotional tie to that channel, regardless of the information they're put for, whether it's factual or not. You know, if you can inspire that person to come back, they've done their job, and it's not participating in spreading fact.
Absolutely. Jeff, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU Radio. Today, we're talking about sports language and its impact on politics. My guests are Ben Zimmer, who writes the Word on the Street language column for The Wall Street Journal, and Barbara Partee, who is a distinguished university professor emerita of linguistics and philosophy at UMass Amherst. And you can please feel free to call in and give us your thoughts or comments at 303-442-4242. Ben, I want to pull you in on some of the things that Jeff was talking about. We sort of established that it's the media journalists who evoked a lot of this early language and sort of brought it into the common lexicon. But when we look at how that language has grown and become more central, And I mentioned Barack Obama loved the sports metaphors. To what extent is it the politicians now or the media that are driving the continued use of the idea, whether it's the horse race or just using sports as that metaphor for politics?
Yeah, I mean, we see it pervading all sorts of political discourse. So, yeah, certainly the horse race talk that the media does, which is with the audience being the general public, but also politicians talking amongst themselves, or you know, when they're working on a campaign together, you know, with like the Hillary Clinton example, they think of themselves as a team, and they may address each other as teammates, and you know, drawing on that sports language that way as well. The first caller raised an interesting example, and that was the use of slam dunk, the basketball metaphor, which was used by the CIA director George Tenet to say, you know, that the case that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction was a sure thing. Of course, he was wrong. But that was an internal discussion that we found out about later that used a sports metaphor. And it's interesting, too, that particular metaphor seems to be a bit misapplied. If you think about a slam dunk in basketball, it's never actually guaranteed. That's actually a very difficult shot to make. You know, if you said like a layup or something that was like an easier shot, it would seem like that would be a better metaphor when you're talking about something that you're certain is going to happen. Perhaps it's just because, you know, ever since Wilt Chamberlain, the slam dunk has seemed like an easy shot for a very, you know, very versatile athletic basketball player to make. But it's just one example of how these terms may enter from sports, but if you think about them, they don't necessarily apply exactly as they would in, you know, in the original context. They may take on a life of their own.
And isn't that, though, very common with idiomatic language, that over time they change in meaning, that it's really the public that kind of appropriates it and chooses the meaning that they think is fit, regardless of what the initial meaning might have been?
Absolutely. And, you know, we see that all the time. We can trace the etymology of a particular word or phrase back to some sports usage. For instance, Donald Trump using big league. That comes out of late 19th century baseball usage when the major leagues were originally established. Over, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century, it took on this more figurative sense of something significant or important. You could use it as an adjective to describe, you know, a big league player then becomes a big league something else. That kind of transfer to things beyond sports. And then what Donald Trump was doing was using it in this unusual adverbial way, we're going to win big league, which was so unusual that people, of course, misunderstood what he was saying as bigly, B-I-G-L-Y. So in that process, whatever grounding that term had in baseball long ago has been completely forgotten, and people put on their own interpretations and their own usage, as, you know, happens with language in general.
We have another caller. It's James in Boulder. James, you're on KGNU Radio.
Thanks, guys. Great topic. A couple of things, if you don't mind. First, I wanted to talk about like the ethics between business and sports. You know, like because the sports are so visible and public, that there's a greater degree of ethics that I'd say. Like we've had a couple of recent examples where that's not the case. I mean, like at the Boulder County Commissioners, they were talking about extending the moratorium on the fracking. And, you know, one of the ladies was just saying it's just insane that we consider, you know, these fossil fuels, which are destroying the environment. And why? All because of the profits, because the dollars. And so these companies just don't have that ethics. I remember one time a CEO one time said, it's not just to be the best, but it's that the competition is crushed. You know, so there's very little sportsmanship in that.
For sure. It's interesting because, you know, we sort of discussed earlier in this conversation that perhaps people in the business world don't use the sports metaphors publicly as often as politicians. You know, definitely not going to dispute what you're saying about the business world. But then why do you think that perhaps maybe they don't use it? Are they just more savvy that they don't want to sort of call out their competitiveness on the business side? Or why do you think that sports metaphors tend to migrate more towards politics than they might towards business?
Well, I think actually, you know, here's a little metaphor. Because the game, you know, our Constitution is a document that protects property and commerce. That's wealth. And so that's the game. That's what the CEOs and the ruling class would like, is the more wealth. So whatever favors them. So that's how the rules are defined, rather than in sports where the rules are a little bit more equitable, and because it's public that they bring in the ethical component.
Gotcha. Great. James, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate your input.
One more thing, if you don't mind.
There
are two more things. Laurel this morning brought in a bridge analogy of Trump. And so like that was something I thought was interesting, as well as back in 2008, Ralph Nader had his own shirt. His campaign manager was from New York, and they brought on the Buffalo Bills logo and using that as the connection between the sports and the politics. So it was a Buffalo for Ralph Nader's campaign. Anyway, I just thought those were pretty interesting.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your contribution, James. Really appreciate it. You're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU Radio. Our topic today is sports language and its impact on politics. It certainly was a type of language that was used tremendously in our most recent election season. And would love to hear from you about whether the emphasis on competitive speech has an impact on how we look at politics, policy, and elections. You can call us at 303-442-4242. It's 9:12, so we have about 18 minutes left in our hour. Barbara, I'd like to talk about, because I always want to think prescriptively here when we talk about these sort of things. And to what extent could sports language be used for the better? Because we do talk about the competitive piece of sports language, but there's also a collaborative piece to sports. Ben mentioned in Hillary Clinton's speech after she had lost the election that she talked about her people who worked on her campaign, leaving it all in the field, that you can infuse drama, but infuse it in a way that isn't competitive as much as grateful for the grit and the hard work that one uses. I mean, we think of Teddy Roosevelt's famous arena speech, where it's not necessarily a sports speech, but it has that sports feel to it and can be very motivating in that way. Is there a way or belief that sports language could be used to sort of greater our appreciation of the process?
It's interesting. I was thinking about that before this program and looking for examples, and I did see Obama having spoken about the need to team up to get things done as a call for bipartisanship, which is exactly the opposite of what most of this language has been doing, which has been emphasizing the competitive nature and increasing partisanship. But I couldn't find very many examples of that sort. I mean, I've never seen any sports metaphors coming from synchronized swimming. I mean, we have a few sports that are not, that emphasize the positive aspects of the teamwork more than paying so much attention to the competition. But I'm afraid, for better or for worse, what the public eats up is the competitive nature. I would love to see more of the positive, of the need for teamwork. I mean, people talk about having to reach across the aisle, but I've never seen a sports metaphor for that other than this idea of needing to team up.
Just to follow up on that, Barbara, as someone who watches the development of language, how do you shift that perception? Is it possible? I mean, is language something that there is no one who truly controls it? And it's, my study of it, I sort of feel like, yes, there on rare occasions, a smoking gun when one person coins something and we all sort of follow it. But a lot of times it's just sort of this critical mass and we see that we reach a tipping point, to use another sort of cliche phraseology here, and that people just start using it. Is there a way to sort of think about language in a more sort of hands-on way and make a decision to make a move in sports language and the way we use it in politics?
Well, it's interesting. If I heard you right, you started this question to me by saying you wanted to look at things prescriptively. Was that right?
Yes.
Because linguists are always talking about this distinction between prescriptive grammar and descriptive grammar. Prescriptive is the grammar teachers and the textbooks telling you how you should talk. And descriptive is the linguist studying how people do talk and write. And linguists as a whole are very solidly convinced that trying to do things prescriptively is a marginal endeavor at best, that the language evolves, the influences come from people who write and people who speak, and if there's anybody who has influence on changing the language, it will be the language users. It won't be teachers or authors of textbooks, and I'm sure Ben will back me up on this, that the great dictionaries are recording the changes that happen, even though ordinary people often look at the dictionaries as the place to settle disputes about how a word should be used.
Ben, I want to bring you in on this. We have another caller waiting, and I'm going to get to that caller in 1 second. But I do want to ask you about this, because I agree with you, Barbara, and it makes perfect sense. Is there one group, though, that could make that change? And I'm talking about the media, that if the media made that conscious decision to sort of shift, could that lead to a shift? Ben, what do you think?
If members of the media are open to self-reflection, and certainly there has been a lot of media criticism over some of the things we talked about, particularly the horse race aspect of politics. But I think we can also look to sports metaphors. You were asking for examples of, you know, how they might be used in a positive way. And the last caller mentioned Ralph Nader, and that reminded me that, you know, one term that Ralph Nader helped to bring into the public conversation is whistleblower. And that one does have, you know, originally a sports usage, blowing the whistle, originally referred to a referee either in boxing or in football, where the whistle is blown and there's an official break in the action. Perhaps there's a penalty assessed if it's football. And that idea of blowing the whistle ended up taking on a new meaning where you're objecting to something shady going on. And Ralph Nader very skillfully brought in this particular idiom when he was trying to encourage, you know, people in government or corporations to speak out about, you know, things that were going on that the public should know about. And he didn't want them simply to be called, you know, something bad, like a rat or an informant or something like that, that they weren't ratting people out, they were blowing the whistle. So, you know, that's an example of what was originally a sports metaphor being used in an interesting kind of progressive way, you could say, in order to draw on a sort of a different kind of discursive tradition, to get away from more negative terms in order to, you know, encourage people to take this kind of civic action.
That's a great point. I'd like to get to our phone lines. We have Jeff in Boulder. Jeff, you're on KGNU Radio.
Yeah, the late Dr. Ettinger, he was asked, what would be an alternative to entertainment? And he says, drama, authentic drama. You see, the role with entertainment is that it's so utterly shallow. Drama was meant to be a religious experience. It was supposed to reach such depths that it has that religious dimension to it, and that's what's been totally lost. So that we have just the tail end of the religious numinous dimension of the idealization of pop stars, and you could include sports figures into that. But I also wanted to say that along the lines of the archetypal dimension, that I wrote a poem just recently that was, that, you know, and I use a lot of sports metaphors in my writing. And one of them that I used, which surfaced out of, you know, kind of the gutter of the language that's used in sports, was the wow factor, or the it factor. And it's the most banal, again, it's a vulgarization, but it gets at the point. I mean, Bernie has the wow factor. He's got it, okay? And so does Trump. I mean, in a very negative way, but they have the wow factor. And when you're sitting on a bench in sports and the guy next to you goes out on the ice or he goes out on the field or whatever it is, or you're in the stands, or the young woman or whoever it is, you can see the person who has, they have that wow factor or that the it factor, whatever you want to call it. And sports is again as much of a degradation of as it is of the divine drama. It is all we. It's one of the only things we have right now. And so it's a double-edged kind of sword situation. I mean, it's what we have. It's one of the ways that we take in the divine drama and art, or whatever you want to call it. So anyway, that's my comment.
Jeff, it's an interesting point. It's almost as if sports are synthetic drama. It's sort of like a manufactured drama.
They're a vulgarization, and the Greeks, you know, had the agon, you know, and that's how people learned about. I mean, that's how culture was formed. It was formed through the divine drama, and that's how we evolved. And so
along those lines, though, how does language play into that? I mean, we could talk about sports.
You start talking about language, then you start talking about symbols, you know, and then you start talking about the image, you know, imagistic and so forth. And the woman who on your program right there that's talking about, you know, definitions and. You know, what is it? The definitions of language? I mean, when you start looking into the background behind the language, the Jungians were very interested, still are very interested in the origins of language, but it stems, you know, a lot of it stems out of, you know, the senses, and it stems out of, imagery, but it comes out of sight and sound. And taste and so forth, and so it's all tied in together. But I think what Dr. Ettinger is saying, that you know, drama, authentic drama. I mean, when we hear again, when we see something or we hear something that is really compelling, okay, whether it's in a poem or in a song or whatever it is, I mean, it touches us automatically. And yeah. I limit myself to the amount of sports that I watch, but that's what I'm really, I think, caught by mostly is when I see,
gotcha.
When I see a young kid out there that's, you know, playing for the first time, he never got drafted. He never was picked up by anybody. And he comes out of nowhere like an Andrew
right.
Shaw. And he butts the puck into the net with his head. I mean, what are you going to say? You're not going to see that, you know, in most realms of our. Again, we don't have good drama and art, so
right.
So that's where you find it. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Take care.
Barbara, I want to. Thank you. I want to bring you in on what Jeff was talking about the effectiveness of drama that sports brings, this sort of synthetic drama. Let's talk about, for the last few minutes here on the show, about the effectiveness of sports language, particularly in the political realm. I mean, you see politicians keep on going back to sports language. Is it truly effective? Do you find, and I want to ask Ben the same question, whether or not you both find that sports language is truly an effective vehicle for conveying ideas on the political stage?
Well, Well, I think when we're talking about the elections and the campaigns where it's clearly all competition, I think it probably is. If we talk about governance, you know, once we have a government in place, then I'm much less sure of it. But for the campaigns where so much intense effort is going to defeat the other side, I think what someone mentioned earlier, this evoking, maybe it was you, I guess, I've forgotten now, evoking loyalty to a team, and you stay with your team rather than looking closely at what the policy issues are that are at stake. I think it seems to be very effective in promoting team loyalty and wanting to stick with your team, and it makes the polarization greater. It may be part of the kind of thing that makes Bernie fans not want to support Hillary. I mean, I'm an Orioles fan. So if the Orioles have lost, who would I support? You know, if my team isn't going further in the competition, do I look at what team is most similar to my team? Probably not. I mean, we don't have the same notion of policy issues, right, with our teams.
Yeah.
But I'm likely to want to go with a team that I had some other reason to feel some emotional loyalty to. I think, I don't know. I mean, I think it is very effective. It takes me from focusing on the issues. So I think it's a problem.
Yeah, Ben, and we just have about 3 minutes left, so, you know, maybe in a minute, give me your thoughts on whether there is an inherent misdirect in using sports language, that it pulls you away from what's central. I guess idioms or euphemisms, which are another form of language, inherently do that. They sort of take you away from the central point. But is there a misdirect that's a big problem here that takes us into getting into a binary rooting for one or the other rather than being more holistic and looking at these issues more broadly?
Well, I would say yes. On some level, it's true that the sports language may reduce things to, you know, us versus them on this very elemental level. On the other hand, I would say that, you know, we use metaphors to understand the world, to make sense of the world. We shouldn't just think of them as some sort of, you know, false consciousness or some sort of, screen on reality. It helps us understand the world and make sense of the world. And so if we're using sports to do that, that's one way to do it. We just have, you know, various metaphors that we can draw on. They may mislead us. You know, I gave the example of the slam dunk metaphor, which definitely was not helpful with the WMDs. But, you know, I see lots of other examples. Just to take one example, the idea of ground game versus air game, which of course comes out of football and, you know, whether you're passing or running. But that gets applied in this new way to political campaigns where the ground game is sort of getting out the vote and the air game is running commercials on the airwaves. And I find that kind of thing fascinating. It's like taking that language and finding some new use for it. So I see a lot of creativity and inventiveness and you know, I focus on that positive aspect of it.
Well, I definitely find it fascinating as well. And I'm sad to say, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I really want to thank both of my guests today. Both of you are very distinguished in this field and are very kind of you to spend the hour with us. Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. If you do not read his Word on the Street column, you very much should. It's something I look forward to each week. And he's also a former columnist for the Boston Globe and the New York Times Magazine. He was the first ever recipient of the Linguistic Journalism Award and has worked as an executive editor of Vocabulary.com and the Visual Thesaurus, and was editor for American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press and as a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary. And Barbara Partee, every bit as distinguished as well, as you can tell from her title. She is the Distinguished University Professor Emerita of Linguistics and Philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is one of the founders of contemporary formal semantics in the United States and is the former president of the Linguistic Society of America. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been your host, Josh Chetwynd. And next up, please stay tuned for Uncle Jeff and the Morning Sound Alternative.